This episode is brought to you by 6 Feet Up, the Python, Django, and AI experts who solve hard software problems. Whether it's scaling an application, deriving insights from data, or getting results from AI, 6 Feet Up helps you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com. Hello, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent with Carlton Gibson. Hey, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to have Adrian Halavati, who is the creator of Django, up here. Welcome, Adrian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No, yeah, thanks for me. No, we've been trying to get you for years. I'm really excited that you could join.
I finally made the room in my agenda.
That's right. Well, maybe I'll just quickly jump to, so it's been over 20 years since you first created it. What have you been up to since then, right? I think mainly this SoundSlice project, or what would you like to say about, you know, you,
what you've been up to these days?
Well,
SoundSlice is my day job. I've been working on that full time since 2012. It's no longer safe to call it a startup. It's just a business, and it's a way for people to practice music. It's used by all sorts of musicians to practice, to teach, to transcribe stuff. It's basically a web-based interactive sheet music platform with all sorts of stuff attached to it. So that's how I make a living. And there's no end in sight. It's the project that keeps sprouting new features and new challenges. And it's super interesting. It's a great combination of my two parts of my life, music and computer programming.
Right. I mean, you did call it Django after Django Reinhardt. So it's not a new thing. I guess that would be a question. Which came first, jazz guitar or programming for you?
Oh, interesting. Well, it depends on your definition of programming coming into my life, because I did some as a kid, just copying code from a magazine and putting it into my Commodore 64. I don't know if that really counts. My first big thing was a calculator program for the TI-85. In high school math class. It was called AMath, and it did basically all the formulas. And basically, by the time I graduated, everyone in the advanced math classes had that. And I became obsessed with making it more optimized, adding features, removing bytes. Like, at some point, I find out that the size of the variables influence the size of the ultimate compiled code. So I have renamed every variable to just a single character. Like, and this I don't know, 15 or something. So that was probably my first programming thing. And I was a guitar player, but not a jazz guitar player. So I guess programming came first.
15 years old, you've got the memory to like recall what variable A and variable B and variable C, what they sort of refer to, right?
Yeah, I mean, couldn't do that anymore. I forget if I had it written down or something, but I still have it, actually. It's right here in my desk.
Good. Nothing goes to waste,
right? 85 calculator. So for those of you watching, boom.
Wow.
It's got EMath on it. I don't know why it's so at the ready. I just have to be on my desk because all my accoutrement.
You can get Python on the latest version of those, right?
I heard that a few years ago. That's awesome. Because this thing was some bastardized version of, it was some proprietary Texas Instruments language. And I still have the manual on my bookshelf over there. Speaking of weird things that I've kept around for decades.
Wow. And yet, I think you didn't formally study computer science in college, is that right?
I did almost complete a minor.
Okay.
So I studied, C and assembly language. And then there was a web development class that I took that focused on Perl. Mm-hmm. And so my original web development programming was with CGI and Perl.
Yep.
That must have been 2000, maybe 1999.
Wow. Okay. And then was it 2003 or 2004 when you started on Django internally?
Because
it was released in 2005, so it must have been at least 2004, but maybe 2003 when you started working on it.
I would have to look that up. I don't want to just say one of the days
because
I don't know for sure. But yeah, that's the right ballpark. One of those 2 years.
That is kind of wild, though. 3 years after your first web class, you switched to Python, which at the time wasn't what it is today. And you're like, no, let's just do a web framework. Because I guess PHP was the frustration, right? Like that was the kind of the default, and you had experience with PHP.
Yeah, I was using PHP. I switched from Perl to PHP at some point because that was kind of the trendy thing at the time.
It was the new hotness, right?
It was the new hotness. And yeah, then Simon Wilson and I were big fans of this blogger called Mark Pilgrim. And he wrote a lot about Python around that time and actually released a free online book called Dive into Python. So that influenced us to just try playing around with Python, and we really loved it and just started building stuff in it to the credit of our boss, who really didn't mind as long as stuff got done. So that's something I'm eternally grateful for, is that sort of hands-off approach by management. His name was Rob Curley, and his famous quote was, "I don't care how the sausage gets made, as long as the sausage gets made."
I mean, that's the dream for any programmer, I think.
Definitely, yeah.
Well, Carlton, I have a long list of questions. You jump in here.
Yeah, well, no, I want to ask a little bit more about SoundSlice and about the underlying. So it's all built in Rust, right? No, I mean, you built with Django in the back end.
Not Rust. So all the back end is in Python, and the web stuff is in Django. The most interesting, well, I take that back. The front, I was going to say the most interesting, but I actually don't think that anymore. The front end is all in JavaScript, of course, because that's the only game in town. And it's the interesting thing about the front end is that it's an entire sheet music rendering engine in JavaScript. So what that means is we take the semantic data, like the pitch C followed by the pitch B flat, and we actually turn that into graphics, like, you know, the dots and the lines and all that stuff. So that's, and it's responsive, so it'll fit. It's dynamically generated for whatever your screen size is, because a lot of musicians are using smartphones and tablets these days.
Right.
So that was the original interesting bit of the project. Unfortunately, not Python, because you can't do Python, or at least I guess now these days you technically can with some really weird hacks, but yeah, it's all JavaScript. And then on the back end, we do have a new interesting thing, which is sheet music scanning. It's the basically OCR, but for sheet music. It's called OMR, optical music recognition, where you can upload a photo or PDF of sheet music and we'll figure out the semantics of it and reconstruct it so you can hear it, you can edit it. And yeah, you get the fungible data. And that's all using our custom machine learning stuff in Python. No Django stuff really. Oh, I guess there's Django stuff because there's like a web interface to it.
But Django would be just the web layer, right? The sort of interface layer, the view layer. And then
Exactly. Well, I mean, we store data in Postgre and access that with Django models. So I mean, it's not just the web stuff that's Django, but yeah, it's all Python behind the scenes.
Okay, so I've got two questions. The first one would be like, because now 2012, you said you started it, so that's like 13, coming up 14 year old project. And I guess I wanted to ask you about stability and maintenance, because one of big Django's big selling points, you know, at least in the last say 5 to 10 years of its life, has been about, you know, the stability and the ease of upgrade. And you know, as someone running a business using it, I mean, I wonder what your thoughts there are. You know, obviously it's a benefit. But
I'm very happy. I'm happy that it's the Django is stable. I mean, at some point it started doing everything I needed, and that's sort of around the time where I decided, you know, I don't really want to spend hours of every day on this anymore, because for me, Django was always about a tool that helps you build cool stuff, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to work on this quote unquote academic project of making the best possible framework. It was always just a means to an end for me, and it continues to be so. So yeah, I'm glad it's stable. But yeah, again, at some point it started doing everything that I need. And we upgrade to new Django versions, and occasionally there's something that we'll find interesting. We being my colleagues, Joseph and Edward, that something that we'll find interesting. But I was cool with it a long time ago, back in 2012.
So that's a good selling point, right? Because you could understand maybe you're like tired of it in a way, right? When having worked on it from the beginning, but
no, it's great because it just gets out of the way. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to learn something new every 6 months like it is if you're on the JavaScript front end framework train, which is another sort of passion of mine, is not deliberately not using all JavaScript frameworks, no React, no Angular, or whatever the heck the new thing is. Just vanilla JavaScript does the job and is fantastic, frankly. I have a whole theory on that, which you may have to say for another podcast episode.
Oh, I don't know about that. We'll have it out of you yet. But can I ask you then, because in the last couple of years, there's been this big, HTMX has jumped onto the scene, and there's been this big sort of swing back to the server render multiple pages instead of single page applications. I was wondering if you've obviously seen that going through, and if you've had thoughts, and does that fit your way of thinking? Or
I've totally sidestepped I sidestepped that entire pendulum swing from client side rendered to server side rendered. I've just always done server side rendered. It's always been really good, really fast. It's what browsers are optimized to work with. I do not understand why you need a virtual DOM. That is ridiculous. So I haven't used the new thing, but I feel like I don't need to, because the way that we write JavaScript at SoundSlice is just so dumb and simple, and I mean dumb and as a good thing. There's no abstract. See, the big difference between front end and back end frameworks is that on the front end, you get penalized for abstractions because the user has to download more, and you get penalized because the user has to run more logic. On the back end, you don't have to worry about that as much. So in terms of Django stuff, it's totally fine for there to be abstractions and various layers and stuff. But on the front end, that to me, that does not make sense. And it's just so much better if you are as close to the metal as possible, to the extent that we can call JavaScript metal, which really shouldn't, but remove as much abstraction as possible, basically, is the idea for JavaScript.
So the last couple of years, you've just been like, oh, welcome back in, as the folks come back into the room, you've been keeping the firewall.
Honestly, I go back and forth about whether I even care.
Yeah.
The nice, a huge luxury of having our own business with just three developers is we don't have to worry about the stupid trends. Because, there's one legitimate reason you would need to worry, which is hiring, because often it's easier to hire if you can target a specific framework and you can, make sure that it's sort of a way of pre-qualifying potential coworkers. But for us, we just don't care. And I wish more people would do that. And the philosophical question I have that I've been battling with for years is, to what extent should I care about that publicly? For a while, I just sort of was in my own little cocoon and was happy to watch the world burn in terms of using such stupid JavaScript stuff. But at some point, I realized it's actually detrimental to me indirectly, because the more these frameworks get used, the crappier the web gets. Things get bogged down. Pages take forever to load. It's just a crappy experience, and it's because to some extent of these JavaScript frameworks. At some point, I decided maybe it is worthwhile to be a little bit more public about why using these JavaScript frameworks is not good. Even if you don't use them yourself, you're affected by them negatively, because they sort of impact the reputation of the web at large. And if you're building a website, you're
indirectly impacted by that.
So you never felt the need to have iOS or Android apps then, I think goes without saying. Because Carlton, I mean, I'll say Carlton has, I think, made his career doing the back end of that. And then you've dabbled a little bit in the front end, right? With various projects recently too.
Well, me, I've been using HTMX and Alpine, and it was when I discovered them, because I used to use jQuery and a teeny bit of Backbone when that first came around. I was like, yeah, this is nice. This is okay. And then for me, the whole world just went mad. And I was like, I was busy doing iOS stuff. So I couldn't keep up with, all the JavaScript frameworks. And then I've been using Elm, which I really enjoyed for the sort of functional nature. And that was quite good fun. But then when I found HTMX, I was like, oh, yes, because it goes back to doing it in the web. And yeah, you haven't used HTMX per se, but you've been doing the same, the same kind of thing with yourself by the sounds of it. And it really went back to me to like kind of how the web wants to work. And it fitted Django's pattern so very well, because it was, just make a post request, just make a get request, just make a delete request, whatever. It was with the grain of the web, which is something I've always said about Django. Like, Django's got a grain. If you just go with it, it makes life very simple. It's when you try and fight the grain that it becomes more difficult.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. Well, right, so you wanted to talk about native apps versus the web?
I was just teasing Carlton, because he spent some time, even on some individual projects. I mean, Button, we can say its name, right? You were doing some stuff with apps.
Yeah,
now that you have full choice with what you're doing, it's like you don't need to mess around with that.
I liked what you were saying, Adrian, about just being a small shop with the three of you. You can not care. You can, you almost. I make the joke about being hiding up the mountain herding my goats. But there's this tension between wanting to try the new things, wanting to keep up, wanting to, just go with the state of the art and develop, versus the stability of known tools that really do the job. And so rarely for me does a new tool actually improve it.
Yeah, I would maybe push back on the premise of that statement, which is that new equals state of the art. It's not necessarily true.
No, exactly. It's that tendency though. Oh, we must check out this. We must check out that. To otherwise, we're getting behind somehow.
Well, with that said, I did have a question for you, Adrian. So, if you had to do a new web framework in Python today, is there any bit of Django that you go, I might change that? There must be something.
Yeah, the fact that the settings are global is, I think, was a bad design decision. I would find a better solution for that. I probably would have like a settings object instead of just having it in a module, a bunch of global variables within the module. And the whole setting, the Django settings module environment variable it makes things awkward in certain situations. I would try to find a better way of doing the things that was supposed to solve. In terms of the nitty-gritty of views, URL patterns, models, templates, views I think are really good. If anything, I would not have created generic views, because I think that set a weird, messed up expectation with people that was a good thing to do. And in fact, I think they're not worth the mental complexity whenever you work with them, because you have to hold so much in your head, so much more than if you're just doing writing it out from scratch. I often think about the physical work of being a programmer is so easy compared to anything in the real world. Compared to being a plumber, electrician, you get to sit at your desk and the extent of your movement is your fingers. So for programmers to be up in arms about not wanting to type a lot, that argument does not resonate with me. I would nearly always rather just copy and paste some stuff than have abstraction for the sake of abstraction. And I think that's what we had with Django's generic views. You just have to hold too much in your head. But if you just have all the code written out, it's
so much clearer and easier to understand and more maintainable. So
That last one, it's more maintainable. It's like when you come back to read it, and if you have written the whole method out by hand, it's really easy to make the one time edit. Whereas if you just use the generic views and you've perhaps overridden one class, which is a one line hook, and it is, oh, where does that go? And you have to go and look it up. That can be taxing.
Yeah. So yeah, that one, what else? I think the template language, there's some fundamental limitations to the template language. I remember emailing with Armin, who made Jinja. Emailing with him years ago and asking, well, what would it take for us to benefit from the Jinja optimizations and, you know, all the stuff that's better about it and integrate that into Django? And he did a bunch of research and just decided, you know, there's some fundamental problems, thus it can't be done. So I would want to fix those fundamental problems so that we can, you know, benefit from the Jinja approach to things. But otherwise, I think we got a lot of things right. And I don't mean that in a tooting our own horn way. I just think like it's fine.
It's not a bad scorecard 20 years on, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. What I like about your answer there is all the things you picked, the kind of fine detail thing. Like, you know, the settings, I get it. It's not architecturally fine, but it's not architecturally as good as it can be, but it works. It's not that much of a trouble, you know. You need to put it somewhere. You know, complaints about the generic views, they're kind of, you know, standard conversation at a Django meetup. That's okay. You know, we can live with it. There's nothing fundamental, right? And as Will says, 20 years later, that's perhaps why.
Yeah, but I mean, the huge caveat is that I and Simon and Jacob and all the original contributors wrote this to fit our way of thinking. So I'm one of the worst people in the world to ask about this because it's, you know, it's inherently my way of thinking. So it works the way I think it should.
If I could extend that. So what didn't fit your way of thinking about maybe PHP in particular, right? Like what caused you to say, you know what, I'll do my own version. There must have been some frustration separate from just the language and the approach that the frameworks at the time took.
Interesting. Well, the approach with PHP was that the code was littered in the template. And I know you can have some discipline and not do that, but I'm pretty sure that's how we did it, is just having .php files that are basically a mixture of HTML and PHP code. And that is really hard to maintain. That's probably one of the biggest things. Yeah, honestly, I don't remember. You'd have to interview 2002 Adrian for that one.
This portion of Django Chat is brought to you by 6 Feet Up. What's stopping you? Maybe it's an application that won't scale or an AI initiative that just isn't delivering. That's where 6 Feet Up comes in. With deep expertise in Python, Django, and AI, they solve hard software problems, modernize platforms, and get teams to market faster. Their impact speaks for itself. Automating healthcare pipelines for hospitals, helping NASA explore Pluto, building severe weather prediction tools, and applying AI to connect farmers with vital crop data. When the stakes are high and the problems are hard, 6 Feet Up is the partner that delivers. See what's possible at 6feetup.com.
Back in the day, that was glorious to a sort of certain period. You know, the first few days of a project, that was just wonderful. And then it tail off after a while.
Yeah. And you know, there's something I like about it, which is it's so accessible to people. You don't have to, if you have a PhD in computer science, to just edit a PHP file. It's so easy to deploy. Just throw it on a server that has mod PHP. Boom, you're done. There's some advantages for sure.
Yeah. I mean, to go back to the way you think, and like, you know, we'll talk about the Django book that Will's resurrected us last week that you wrote. It's how I learned Django. But one of the things I really liked about the template language was coming from PHP
was the discipline. It forced, you know, it had loops, it had conditionals, but it didn't let you just dump your business logic in the template. And, you know, often people will come on the forum and they'll be want to, you know, add some much more complicated behavior to the template language. It's always the same old hands going, no, we like it how it is. We like it. Do a template tag, you know, keep it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can use whatever template language you want, Obviously.
But it was about that way of thinking about it. I think, you know, reading the Django book that you and Jacob did was to learn Django. That was like, okay, yeah, this is the way to think about it. Will, here you go. You pulled it up.
Okay, pull it up. Yeah, so, and this ties in, I think, to a question about just community, but you and Jacob wrote the original Django book, which is now up at djangobook.com. That obviously helps, I think, to have a free, good book on the community, right? This is still an issue for any framework, is like, what's a good free resource to help people out?
Well, back in the day, I remember there was a lot of hesitation from book publishers to write a book about Django because they considered our docs so good and they thought it wouldn't be a commercially viable idea to have a book because the docs pretty much said it all.
I've got a question right there about the, because the Django docs are, you know, objectively very high standard, but there's often complaints or not complaints. Complaints isn't the right word. There's often like a desire for them to say a lot more about how to use Django and strategies and the more kind of discursive content, which it's interesting whether we have the capacity A to write, B to maintain, whether the docs are the right place for it, or whether books are, you know, books and courses are, you know, the sort of extra resource that you need alongside kind of more solid reference docs. And what you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't have a strong.
Okay, another way of phrasing it is, why isn't the Django book just in the Django docs? Why was it a separate thing?
Well, if I remember correctly, a couple of the chapters were taken from the docs and edited for sure and expanded, but I think we even put some back into the docs. Yeah, I could see an argument either way. I could see an argument for giving a commercial incentive to authors, because writing a technical book is so much work for so little money that maybe they deserve the money they actually can earn from it. But at the same time, if it's an open source project, the docs, you know, should include as much information as possible. And maybe the biggest limitation is just making sure that they don't go out of date. This is something I face with SoundSlice, because we have a very extensive help section, hundreds of pages. And there comes a point where anytime you make a feature change, you start to groan a little bit because you're like remembering all the documentation pages you need to update. You know, the hardest thing is the screenshots.
Yeah, right.
Because it's easy to edit, but the screenshots, and sometimes we have animated GIFs with, you know, showing parts of the UI and you have to redo those. That's why we basically stopped making YouTube videos, because like that goes all out the window once you change anything. Just as an aside, I think videos, it's so much better to make instructional content in text than in video for, you know, with the caveat that there are certain things, like if you actually need to see something, like it's some sort of home improvement, obviously it's better to have a video. But in general, I think that's something that's changed in the world over the last few decades, not necessarily for the better, is this expectation that you search YouTube first. Like my son, who's 14, he had a task and I asked him to look something up and he just immediately went to YouTube to look it up, even though it's like something that a single web page would have very easily answered. So anyway, long story short, why am I even talking about this?
No, I mean, I agree. Like, I've written books too, you know, but I have a soon to be 13-year-old, you know, she doesn't use Google at all. Like, she just uses LLMs actually.
No.
Because I don't let her use YouTube at home. So, you know, some of this has just been negated by the fact that, yeah, LLMs, like in the most recent Django survey, asking how people found and learned Django. So the docs, I think, were 79%. And then tied at 38% was Stack Overflow still, though that will probably decline, YouTube, and AI, meaning like ChatGPT. So I would strongly suspect that, you know, everyone just goes to an LLM now. So that's sort of the thing. Like, obviously, I'm biased towards text because you sort of lean in, you can take your time, you're not stuck on someone else's schedule. But everyone's just like, what's the economic incentive for text when you don't even get attribution anymore? You know, so for me and any other technical book author, we've all seen since around 2022, when something happened, just traffic, sales fall off a cliff. So, you know, I mean, and more generally too, if you think about even just the underlying economic basis for the web, you know, what's the point of, you know, affiliate links? Like, you know, why review 10 great hiking backpacks? You know, it used to be if you ranked, you could get traffic and then you could make some affiliate money. But now if the LLM just gobbles it up, there's really no incentive to do that. Though actually one thing I heard interestingly is that, Google is actually missing out on this because it's sort of versioning, creating a version of the web that then the LLMs are consuming. So people are just using Google's work, semantically labeling the web, and then Google's missing out on that. But I can't say I feel so bad for Google. But what do they call it? AEO? It's the LLM-led search thing. It's a brave new world, but you know, some products, you know, for example, Button Down, which is a newsletter built with Django, Justin Duke, we've had in the show, who's at DjangoCon US, it's now, I think his number two referral is LLMs. Like if you go into an LLM and say, what, you know, other than Substack, what should I use? Like his service pops up, right? So it's...
Well, I had an experience with that a couple months ago.
Oh, you did? Yes, please. Yeah. Please, if you don't mind repeating the story.
Yeah, well, so I mentioned the SoundSlice sheet music scanner. Every day or so, I look at the error log just to prevent misuse and see the images that didn't get any good results. And I started to see screenshots of ChatGPT where they were saying, copy and paste this text into SoundSlice, into their ASCII tab feature, and you'll hear the music played back. Problem is we don't have an ASCII tab feature. So ChatGPT was telling people about something that does not actually exist. So we were faced with the question, what do we actually do? We're not going to be able to convince ChatGPT to fix their database. I don't think that's how the nature of these models works. And that's just not going to happen. We could slather our website with notices like, hey, if you're coming to us from ChatGPT and you're expecting this ASCII tab thing, that does not exist, but that's just really lame. So we ended up just making the feature to meet that demand, which is kind of dumb because ASCII tab is a very old-fashioned way of notating guitar tablature that, it's super old school.
I remember that from 30 years ago, find a site, print it out. Like I had binders of
tabs,
and there'd be like four or five versions. You're like, oh, is the third one's the good one? The fourth one's the good one. You know, because the books, they had tab books, but they're pretty expensive. Right? It'd be like 15, 20 bucks back in the day for 14 songs. And it's like, well, maybe it's in the wrong key, but it's close enough. You know, because the key would always be off too. Like,
There's all sorts of problems with the published tabs. The fans who make their own transcriptions are often much more accurate because they care more than...
Right.
Maybe there's a parallel there between open source documentation and the book authors. I don't know. Anyway.
Do you have a phrase for this though? Was it LLM driven development or something? I think you...
Because
you did a blog post on it.
I did a blog post that got some attention and nothing's really happened from it. Although funnily enough, the other day I saw another ChatGPT screenshot in our error logs where someone said ChatGPT incorrectly said that we support yet another thing called Chord Pro format, which that is not a thing. I just think there's like a fundamental problem that our society really is going to have a huge reckoning with if
we're training a whole generation of people to trust this information that is not necessarily true, that is not a good thing.
Well, we're post-truth, right? That was the whole idea, is with the web. Now, all the answers you want, it turns out we're back to kind of misinformation central. I wanted to add, answer engine optimization, AEO. I was just looking at that. That's the phrase for like Gemini or, you know.
How do you do that? How do you insert yourself into their training data?
I mean, it's sort of like the early days of the web with like hidden text. There's all sorts of hacks that kind of work. I remember you can, and you know, if you got in before the training deadline cut off, you have like a 9-month window where like you're ahead because you put in some keywords and someone else didn't. It's all going to filter out. But one thing I wonder about, you mentioned, just to circle back to typing in function-based views. I don't want to make this all about AI, but one thing I found, I just came from a company on-site visit with engineers at PyCharm talking about how we're doing stuff, and using agents, you don't actually type anything yourself. So even if it gets the right answer on a query, which we'll just put that aside and assume it does, if you haven't actually typed it yourself, it like sort of that connection to your brain isn't there. So you don't really feel the code or the logic, or you struggle with it at all. I don't know if you, I guess that's a roundabout way of asking, and I can probably guess, but are you using LLMs at all to help with your code?
With the code, no. Personally, no.
And your team too?
My colleague Edward, who's a designer and can do some, you know, sort of knows enough to be dangerous sort of thing in front end code. He's been using it to make prototypes, and I think it's really a good use case for that. It really has empowered him to make some prototypes, totally on his own as a single person. Would I use AI generated code in our production code base? No, definitely not. I have, of course, tried it, and there's nearly always subtle bugs.
Yeah.
And they run the gamut from outright bugs that anyone familiar with our code base could tell right away to very subtle things like, it technically works, but it's going to cause a problem in the future if we add this one feature. Like, it's these kind of things that we all hold in our heads as the developers of products that the AI doesn't have access to. And another reason is it's fun writing code. I like holding all that stuff in my head and reasoning about it. Why would I not want to do that? Why would I intentionally have less fun? For capitalism reasons, like to churn out more features and make more money? What's the legitimate reason?
Carlton, you have a thought here. Come on.
That rings true to me. I'm going to be 48 years old in a month or so. And why am I still at the keyboard rather than why have I not moved somewhere else after 20 years? It's because I love writing software. It's like, you know, crafting stuff out of nothing. And I write specs. One thing I'm interested in is that people are now suddenly keen to write specs, when for years and years they couldn't possibly write a requirement stuff, but now they'll do it. So they'll do it for the machine, but they'll never have done it for any other reason in the past. But I've always written specs up of what I was trying to do. And so I can paste that into whatever, and I can get some stuff out, and I can look at it, and I can not really understand it, and eventually I can see why it's not as nice as what I might have written. None of that's as enjoyable as just writing the stuff myself. And I don't know. Let's say it makes writing code faster. I'm not convinced it makes writing code faster, but let's say it makes writing code faster. The writing code bit is the least of my job. Like, it's a fraction of my job. That's not what I'm paid for. That's not what I've made a good living in my professional life doing. It's not the writing code bit. It's all the rest of it. And why take the fun away? It's like, if, you know, I enjoy cooking. Am I going to go down the supermarket and buy a microwave meal? Absolutely not.
Exactly. Or like that Soylent stuff. Does that even still exist? You know, a couple years ago.
I think that's passed. I think so. I'm not living in Silicon Valley still, but like, I think there's probably still a dedicated culture, but they've moved on to something else. Yeah.
So let's swing topic momentarily. I was at Django in the Med last week with Jacob, amongst other people, Jacob Wars, who's the new Django fellow, and he's a composer, and he has been into the music world. And he was telling me that you're quite involved in the technical specs for encoding music. It was beyond what I knew about, but it sounded interesting, and I wanted to ask you about it.
Well, there's a format for encoding music notation. Well, there are many, of course,
right?
Because you can argue music notation is the world's most used language, if you consider it a language, but there are many ways of encoding it. And one of the probably the most used, the most popular these days, is called Music XML. So it's, as you could guess, it's an XML format where you encode all the notes, all the rests, all the chord diagrams, all the stuff from your score. And that is now a W3C community group. It's maintained by this W3C community group, of which I'm one of the three co-chairs. And several years ago, my predecessor, this guy Joe Berkowitz, started a project to create a new format to address some of the fundamental limitations of Music XML. Obviously, insert XKCD number, whatever. Another format, blah, blah.
One more standard.
Exactly. It sounds so stupid to say this, but this one will be better. It's JSON. It has a more Pythonic approach to things, to be very...
So is it going to be called Music JSON?
No, it's called MNX, which is not my name. It doesn't stand for anything. It's just a random acronym, Music Notation X, MNX. So I'm in charge of that. I've been working on it for years now, and it's really great. On the off chance that anybody listening here is working on any sort of sheet music thing, definitely check it out and get involved in the development. Fun fact, that documentation system is a Django app. I made this app that has a very specific task of creating documentation for a JSON format where you can have examples and it automatically color codes things and links every attribute of the JSON to the appropriate docs page, blah, blah, blah. And that's all open source anyway. Ooh. So yeah, this is what I do in my free time instead of... It's sort of like what replaced Django for me in my open source contributions time.
But this is the sort of thing that I think, it takes a group of individuals to craft on over a while. And it kind of has really long lasting value because that standard will be finished and then it will be around, but a long time, and a lot
hopefully
of people.
Decades. Yeah, definitely.
That's really cool.
I had just one more question, and this goes back to Django architecture, which is around local versus deployment. So there's still this kind, when you start a new project, it defaults to local, and then that leap to production. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on maybe making that easier, because it is still quite a bit of a leap and everyone does it. When I think about how to put this in a book or to teach it, it just varies so much. There isn't even just a simple path and then we go from there. It's like even that simple path, you still have to tweak, 8, 15 things. Mm-hmm. Just curious if you have any thoughts on, so there's talk of maybe we have, when you start a new project, toggle something like local versus production. That's one idea like Jeff Triplett has explored, but curious what you think.
Think it may be inherently complicated.
Yeah.
So there might not be an easy solution. And I think we as programmers don't like to consider that option. I'm probably one of the worst people to ask because once I set something up for production, it's set and forget it. And
well, right. This is... Again. This is the thing.
I set it up in SoundSlice like more than a decade ago. The other production site I have running, my blog, which I did probably around the same time, Yeah. I personally haven't even faced that in years.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely a bad person to ask about it.
Okay.
It does seem like there could be some sort of more framework level switch between production and development. But yeah, I don't have much to say. Sorry.
It could be explaining that, because that is, you said it and then you kind of go on. Eric Mathis, who's wrote Python Crash Course, he's been working for a while now on this Django Simple Deploy third-party package that links into some common providers and is trying to address that. So, you know, mainly started from his pain point as an author of, you know, he would have a different provider each edition every 3-4 years, and, you know, the free tier would go away or they'd change how they do something. And I can certainly relate to that, just with having, I've switched between Heroku and other, and I can't remember, fly.io. Like, you know, you write this book and people kind of are like, hey, this part's broken. You're like, that's not even the Django part.
I think what's good about Django Simple Deploy is that each provider has a plugin. And so it's a way that plugin then becomes the kind of focus point for people in the community who are, you know, if you're using that, you can contribute to this one plugin so that it's kind of like a shared knowledge bank, if that makes sense.
Nice. Sounds like a great project.
Well, yeah. It's kind of cool. Deployment's one of the perennials, right? Long gone are the days where you could just run, you know, mod Python and it was all taken care of.
You would have thought that it would be solved by now. Not just for Django, but just like sort of for the whole world of web development.
But maybe it's inherently complicated.
Well, but, or if you look at other web frameworks that, you know, that raise VC money, they just have a hosting platform. So like Laravel has a hosting option. Fast API, right? They raise money. They're going to do Fast Cloud, you know, kind of to address this. So, yeah. I have actually one more last question, which is, you mentioned how you, with SoundSlice, you're using Django and data pipelines together. I feel like this is the issue I want to try to get a better story around. And at DjangoCon US, we're talking about how do we say how Django fits into this AI world? Because people will misunderstand how things fit together. Like, there are a lot of people, the new generation are Python machine learning engineers, but they're not web engineers. And so they think, okay, I just have a fast API endpoint, my work is done. But, you know, so I will get a question, and others as well, like, hey, I want the Django ORM plus fast API, which I feel like the question sort of misunderstands what's going on. So I'm curious if you have a sense of how Django can market itself better is like, you know, okay, maybe on the inference path, you don't want Django, but all this other stuff that you need, Django's there for you, but this new generation doesn't even know to ask, really. That's my take.
I have never used Django REST framework, but I'm going to bring it up at the risk of being totally ignorant about it, because like I said, I never used it. I don't understand the point of it. What is so difficult about just making a normal Django view that returns some JSON and that like throws the right HTTP status code if you use the wrong like HTTP method? I don't understand that. And I think there's, maybe it's a generational thing that people expect their hands to be held to such an extent where if something doesn't explicitly have like, oh, this is the thing for writing JSON APIs, that if the product doesn't have that, then they're like totally at a loss on how to do it. I think people maybe are scared of going too low level, even though low level is laughably still high level. We're talking Python here and typing two lines instead of one. So I guess I question the premise of the question, if that makes sense. Maybe it's just a matter of educating these people. Like, yeah, so you're preparing some training data to train a model. Here's how to use the Django ORM to spit out some database records and create a CSV or whatever the format your training data needs. There's no there. It's just, it'll be different for whatever machine learning system you use. Like, so we use like a image classification model, ResNet, it needs the data in a certain format. It's basically like a directory structure. There's no there. You just have to know, yeah, put the files in this this directory, name them this way. You can use Django to do that. It's just writing code. So I'm kind of confused, you know? Like, what's the issue?
And help me out.
Well, no, sorry. I mean, So from your answer, I think the point there is the phrase you said to some people need that handhold. Maybe it is a kind of skill level problem. Like people are expecting just to have out of the box solutions for absolutely everything. And it's like, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess people want the REST API example, people want out of the box solutions for a lot more than just returning JSON responses, I guess. What does REST framework give you? It's got permissions. It's got, it's got generic views that help you out. It's got authentication. It's got rate limiting as part of it. I guess people want those kind of things, which are perhaps more difficult. Andrew Godwin once said to me about the batteries that Django provides. He said Django has to provide the hard batteries, the things you couldn't just write yourself. And yeah, okay.
But I think you're qualified, Adrian, to say, back in my day, we had to write our own web frameworks. So that's part of the, part of the problem.
Well, the thing is that nobody remembers this. Back in the day, it was a joke in the Python community that there were too many Python web frameworks. This was before Django was open source. I remember at a PyCon years ago in Washington, D.C., there was a keynote speaker who put we talked about this on the last podcast.
Well, it's okay. Not everyone. Yeah, on the Talk Python 20th anniversary. Yeah, you mentioned this.
There was a slide. Sorry, say it again.
I was just going to say, if you go to the ASCII ref website, the ASCII.readthedocs.com, which is the docs for the ASCII spec, and you go to the implementations, there's about 15, 20 Python web frameworks that implement ASCII now. It's like, it's almost back to that old days where the thousands may bloom.
Why did I bring this up? Because you were saying back in the day you had to write your own web framework.
Yeah. I was,
you didn't have to. There were so many, and we were kind of embarrassed that we added another one to the list.
Yeah. Well, but, you need that combination of self-desire and maybe, I don't know if I'd say you were naive, but you're just like, yeah, why not, right? Like,
definitely not your own. Definitely. I mean, I was 22 or 23 or something. Simon and I, fun fact, were born 5 days apart. We're both like 22 or something. Definitely not. Yep. Yeah.
Still made of rubber.
Well, it is. I mean, this is so a perpetual thing I have, and maybe it's inherent to the ecosystem, is why isn't there a JavaScript batteries included web framework? Right? There's always a new thing. And I like there kind of is, but there really isn't. There seems to be for each language, there's kind of a Django, right? Like PHP, you have Laravel, Symfony, Ruby, you have Rails, I guess Java, you have Spring. Like it feels like everyone wants to just write everything in JavaScript, or they used to. But there have been efforts, but nothing that I see has any sticking power as like we're just going to do it this way in JavaScript.
Just to be clear, you're talking about server side. Framework.
Yeah, well, maybe that's part of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this gets to the idea I alluded to earlier, where I said I have a whole theory on JavaScript, that JavaScript ecosystem that could be a whole separate podcast episode. I think at some point, this is already being erased from history, which is kind of sad. At some point, it was like 15 years ago, before JavaScript frameworks really came out, before React, before all those things. It was the era of jQuery, and the reputation of JavaScript front-end developers was these were a bunch of clowns. They started out as HTML people. They are not real programmers. They don't know how to do any back-end stuff. Horrible things are being said about these people. My little pet theory is that
that community got a huge chip on its shoulder and it needed to demonstrate, hey, we're real programmers, capital R, capital P. We're real programmers too. Therefore, we're going to abstract the crap out of everything and make these huge architectures just to show how clever and smart we are. And I think that's what created this generation of frameworks. Why did I bring that up?
No, I was asking. Yeah, I was asking. I forget. I asked you something.
I think so. If you grew up in that environment, you don't have the context. If you're 20 or even 30 now, all your professional life, you've known JavaScript web development is using these crazy over-engineered frameworks, and you don't have a sense of the history and like why did that come to be? Not necessarily for good reasons. In my perspective, I'm just one person, but I've been around. I mean, I've been a web developer since the late 90s. So that's a whole thing that I wish more people were aware of. The world of JavaScript client-side frameworks is not, they didn't necessarily get created to scratch an itch, or the itch that was meant to be scratched was not a great itch.
Was also a big company itch, right? It was like Facebook size problems, Google size problems. It wasn't let's make it, you know, for a small group to do. I think that's a big part of it. You can't say that about all the JavaScript frameworks, but like, I mean, Carlton and I mentioned this, you know, like their problems are not your problems. So same thing now, like with ChatGPT, right? They're using what, Remix now or Next.js. And so a lot of people are doing it, writing blog posts, gets on Hacker News, and people becoming programmers think that's the way it's done, right? Like if you go on Hacker News every 6 months, there's like, oh yeah, Django's still around and it works, but it's not like out there in the same way as cutting edge stuff, which again, is not the problem most people are going to have in their professional life, but they think it is.
That, I mean, we're getting into deeper philosophical takes on the world, but yeah, if you're loud and attract a lot of attention, unfortunately, you get attention. If you're just cool and just doing your own thing and you don't care to toot your own horn, chances, you may have the better solution, but just because you don't care to think about marketing, you kind of get screwed. It's a tale as old as time.
Right. I was just seeing something. It was like this, I think it was a Reddit post about like, what's the biggest flex? And my favorite comment was, the biggest flex is not caring what other people think.
Exactly.
Which is like, right? But, you know, yeah.
Carlton. There's a generational thing here, I think, because we talked about like preferring text to video. We talked about learning from typing in magazines, and then what was it, learning from Stack Overflow, and then these
days. DI-85s. I guess those are still around.
Well, okay, but that was before, but then you learned from Stack Overflow, and then now you learn from an LLM. I often think about this long arc of history. I've been using Django for a long, 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 long time now. And when I see a new framework come up and everyone's like, oh, Django's in trouble because we're not like, you know, new hotness. I'm like, hey, take the long view, because in a couple of years' time, new hotness will have faded away and we'll still have the same fundamental problems. And what I haven't quite mastered is how to communicate that without sounding just like, get off my lawn, old man, you know.
Right. We, Carlton and I feel like we're the two old Muppets, you know, up in the balcony a little bit. For a number of reasons, you're like, but you know, there's something to that. Like, were they wrong? Were their takes wrong? Not always.
There's some great YouTube supercuts of those guys.
Ooh, maybe that should be the opening. I've been meaning to add like an opening snippet to the video thing. I'm like, maybe we should just enough so it doesn't violate copyright.
What do we have to do to stay open to the youngsters though? Like, to, you know, the newcomers in, so we don't just sound like old farts.
Yeah, that's a question for wiser people than me. I don't know. But the thing is, I don't care.
Right.
Because
okay.
It's good enough for me, you know? Yeah.
No, it's fair.
So I wanted to swing to just ask you about your music, because you've got some albums and you tell us a little bit about You put one out in the Gypsy Chat.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a full album, and I've got an EP. The EP was released this year, the album a year and a half ago. It's all my own instrumental guitar music. So if you like lyrics, this is not for you.
It's the music that I wanted to see exist, you know, like a certain combination of melodies and harmonies and instrumentation and aesthetic that I like that I haven't found as much as I would like to find. So it's a matter of being the change you wish to see. It's all under my own name on all the streaming services, and so I think we should get a bot
that plays it while the CI is running on your PR, so you can listen to Adrian play.
I'm always
seeing your PR can be managed.
It's weird because I don't want to promote the music. It's like, well, I do and I don't. I don't want people to listen to it just because, like, I'm the Django guy, like. You might not like it. Big deal. Like, if it's not for you, it's not for you. But I like it.
You like
new stuff. Basically every other evening, I'm always recording, songwriting, arranging.
So that's kind of like your other part, your third space, your other.
Yeah. It's so fun, just to make something. Try to make something beautiful.
Well, as we go out, we've been doing favorite books and stuff, but maybe in your honor, we should do favorite jazz guitarists. I'd like to go first. I'll tell you who I like. I'm a big fan of Howard Alden, I think, because I saw Sweet and Lowdown. There's that I'm Always Blowing Bubbles song.
Yeah, Forever Blowing Bubbles.
It's so beautiful. Great. And I was like, who the heck is this? And then I think 10 years ago, that sent me down the rabbit hole of all his stuff. And I mean, he's one of many, but he's just this beast of a guitarist. And kind of the problem is listening to stuff like that, I don't have to tell you, and then you listen to like a rock solo and it's like, it's kind of different things.
It becomes less impressive. That's the curse of getting knowledge about anything, you know?
Yeah.
You just realize that your standards have become a lot higher.
Right. But at the same time, like, most people don't have that level, so they're fine with whatever. Like, you know, so my kids now are always in the car. They're like, play some music. And on the one hand, it's a little bit like, I don't want to, but now I'm like, ooh, I can like slide in, you know, little more mature stuff that I like and see how they do. So, but I'm curious for you, you must have if you had to pick one, a modern jazz guitarist, it must be someone you listen to and go, wow.
Modern. Well, my all-time favorite is Django Reinhardt.
Sure. Yeah.
He is. No guitarist could play as beautifully as he did. He could just play one note and it just sounds beautiful. And in modern jazz guitar, the concept of beauty and just having a lot of beauty is not that prevalent for some reason. It's more about the note choice. Sorry, we're getting into kind of musician talk. It's more, at some point, this is a whole other thing that I have a rant about. At some point, jazz became a university subject. I think it happened in the 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. And then books started to come out. And there's certain things that a book can communicate, and there's certain things that a book cannot communicate. Talking about music, when it comes to music, a book is really good at communicating the exact notes. So the note choice, the pitches, how long they're played, but it can't communicate things like a bend in a note or vibrato. Yeah. You cannot communicate that in any way other than listening to a recording. So there was several generations now of musicians who came up learning in that environment where there's this invisible hand influencing the music that was created, that was influencing them to think about it like what they would learn from a book. And no one plays like Django anymore. But anyway, to rant over, just another aside. That's why I really love the saxophonist Johnny Hodges. He's like my second favorite musician after Django. But there's like a schism in jazz saxophone. There's like Johnny Hodges school, and then there's Charlie Parker's school. Charlie Parker. Yeah. It's all about the note choice, the phrasing. But for Johnny Hodges, it's more about like the beauty. It just sounds so beautiful, the tone. Charlie Parker did not care about that. It's totally different dichotomy. anyway, modern.
No, I can. I can. My kids are all, my wife, they're all super musical, and they're old enough now where the lessons, it's not about the notes. It's all about, you know, taste, or it's about the things that aren't on the page, because everything's on the page. But how do you get to the next levels? You know, they for violin.
Great, they're already at that point.
Yeah,
if you're starting out, you want to do that, but you don't have the technical capabilities, so you're kind of like, it's frustrating.
Yeah, but it's hard to, get that across, right? It's like the first stage is just playing the notes more or less in the time to signature, and then it's all about, you know, the feeling and all these things, and then that's infinite. But
it's just like programming.
A lot of
commonalities for sure. All right, so back to the topic at hand. I would recommend an album by Adrian Mignard and Rocky Grosset called, it's in French, so I'm going to butcher it. Entre Actes.
Carlton's been
Entre
learning
Actes in a horrible American accent.
Is it between octaves or what is it?
I think it means between us.
Okay. Entre nous? Huh. I'll edit. We can look it up and sound learned. Oh, between acts? What is that in Carlton?
I don't know. I haven't got the album.
Well, it's a really beautiful modern jazz guitar album. It's just a duet. Two guitars. Acts.
Obviously in the chat.
Yeah. All right. Well, we could keep talking, but we've already hit about
Carlton's.
Sorry, Carlton. My big love was Miles Davis and Kind of Blue, and then the there was a kind of series of albums he did, Birth of the Cool, and then through to Kind of Blue, and the interplay with him and John Coltrane with Giant Steps and Love Supreme, and that kind of period there. And it gets later on, it all got a bit much for me. I was a bit like, I have to have had a specific mix of narcotics before I listen to the later stuff.
Yeah, right.
That particular period was just beautiful for me.
All right, we'll put links to all of that. Adrian, thank you for taking the time. This is truly, when we started this podcast 6 years ago, we were like, oh, it'd be great to have the creators, you amongst them, on. And now we've had all three, so I feel like we can quit Carlton, right?
Yeah, we can quit now. We can quit. We can go and put our feet up on the beach.
Side quest over. Yeah. Well, but thank you for taking the time, and thank you for sharing your perspective. I'm personally glad that you're popping your head up a little bit more, and I understand the desire to sort of hide out. Carlton and I talk about this all the time, but I'm glad you're sharing your thoughts.
Yeah, well, thanks for giving me a platform to do that. Yeah, it was fun to chat. Thank you.
All right, and we're djangochat.com. We'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to 6 Feet Up, the Python, Django, and AI experts you call for the hardest software problems. From scaling applications to simplifying data complexity and unlocking AI outcomes, they help you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com.